Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome back to New Books in American Studies. I'm the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. My conversation today is with Jonathan S. Kahn, Associate Professor of Religion at Vassar College. He is co-editor with Vincent W. Lloyd of a new collection of essays entitled Race and Secularism in America, published by Columbia University. Welcome back to New Books in American Studies. I'm the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. My conversation today is with Jonathan S. Kahn, Associate Professor of Religion at Vassar College. He is co-editor with Vincent W. Lloyd of a new collection of essays entitled Race and Secularism in America, published by Columbia University Press. The introduction begins with how Martin Luther King Jr., both a religious and black leader, was stripped of both his race and his religion to represent a homogeneous white secularism. 11 scholars come together to forward the argument that secularism in America has been a project that manages or excludes difference by control over both religion and race. Secularism is dependent on managing not just the intertwined racial and religious discourses, but the practices and bodies of ordinary people. Secularism thus becomes white and springs from a managed Protestantism. The abolitionist movement in the 19th century and the civil rights movement in the 20th century are historical examples of resistance to a secularist white consensus. The essays explore the many ways religion and race are circumscribed, how they are entwined, and the ways their management has been refused. In the process, the authors recover the transformative potential of racial and religious discourses in imagining worlds of possibilities and justice. Here's my conversation with Jonathan S. Kahn.
Now let me introduce you to our guest, Jonathan S. Kahn. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts with our audience. This book that you have co-edited with Vincent W. Lloyd examines a neglected aspect of the secularism debate, the intersection of race and religion. But before we get into this debate, tell us a little about yourself, your background, and how you came to co-edit this volume of essays.
Sure. So I got my PhD in the philosophy of religion at Columbia, and I began work as a PhD student on Freud and religion, but always had a deep desire to do work on Du Bois. And finally, I just gave myself over to the souls of black folk and began to think about that. Noticed that there's just been so little written in my field on Du Bois. And what I was interested, the reason why I was interested in Freud, I suppose, had to do with sort of the ways that he, the ways in which, he was trying to think about religion in ways that I thought were complex, although ultimately not enough to get me to really work on him. Du Bois really, for me, embodied sort of this very liminal figure as far as sort of thinking about what counts as religion and what doesn't. And I'm interested in heterodox forms of religiosity, and I'm interested in the lack of solidity in the category. And so I began working on Du Bois, finished a book and had begun thinking a little bit about James Baldwin in these terms as well. And after the book on Du Bois was done, it was around the time that the conversation on the secular was really burgeoning, and it felt to me that the secular is also a conversation about the lack of solidity of the category of religion, and all the language about sort of, the secular being porous or interpenetrated with religion was language that I was interested in. Vincent and I actually began discussing about the ways in which this contemporary almost cottage industry at this point on the secular was really just not talking about race at all. And we were really complexed, really perplexed by that. And so, we have a lot of respect for the Imminent Frame as a website, and yet when we would do searches and read things on the Imminent Frame, it was really remarkable that there was little to no discussion of the place of African America, of race in the Americas, in this conversation on the secular. And so the idea for the volume started really just over dinner one night at an American Academy of Religion meeting with, you know, Vincent and I were having dinner. And we thought we could pull together a really interesting set of scholars to at least start by having a conversation about why has race been neglected in this in the conversation in secularity studies. And that was back, I don't know, I think in 2012, where we held a small symposium of about 13 folks up at Syracuse University, where Vincent at the time was, where he was working. And from that weekend symposium came ultimately the volume.
Okay. To lay down some groundwork for our audience, can you give us a little history of the secularism debate?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, secularity and secularism and the sort of emerges as a prominent category over the course of the 20th century. And, you know, coming out of sort of Weberian type of sociological perspective and Comte, Freud is not incidental to this too. You know, the idea that emerges that somehow sort of this thing called the religious was going to disappear, and that something called the secular, which was going to be rational and technologically informed and guided by science, was going to sort of take over the room and the space that religion occupies in people's minds, and in their lives and in their bodies, and that, you know, eventually the religious is going to wither away, and as it's withering, it's thought to be understood as largely sort of this atavistic quality of in humans. And so those who have it are holding on to something primitive and not necessary. I sort of at times, you know, liken it to an appendix, that the secular sees the religion as an appendix, a useless organ from a time past that can be removed without any real incident. And by the late 60s, you know, usually this gets sort of condensed around the voice of Peter Berger. By the late 60s, Peter Berger was there's this very famous lunchtime talk he gave at the New School for Social Research in which he just pretty much announced that religion was dead, and that only those people who had essentially no interest in the future were going to be interested in, were going to be engaged in religion. And that secularity thesis sort of held reign, particularly in the academy. In the academy, Christian Smith's work on this is remarkable. I love his work on the emergence of the secular in the as an academic category through the 20th century. That notion sort of reigned in the academy until sort of there were little cracks in it in the 80s, and then come the variety of political upheavals throughout the 80s and the 90s, it became clear that to academics that, wow, the secularization thesis is clearly not describing history as we're experiencing it, where religion is persisting in all sorts of forms, you know, good and bad, violent and nonviolent. And then by Charles Taylor's publication of The Secular Age, which is a work devoted to complicated what the secular might be if we don't take the secular to mean the eventual obsolescence of religion, by 2004, I think is when The Secular Age gets published. It's sort of accepted that the secularization thesis is dead. And Peter Berger in 1999, you know, as the 20th century is beginning, sort of famously recants his claims about the death of religion. And he says that all the secularization thesis stuff needs to be understood as essentially wrong and rethought.
And there's a lot of words that are all associated that are tied together: religion, religiosity, the religious, secular, secularism, secularity.
Yeah.
This vocabulary I think now the conversation, these things are all very intertwined.
Right.
And this is now everybody's trying to figure out how are they intertwined.
Right, right. And how to use them. And there's sort of people conjugate secular and, you know, so that secularism is different from secularity, which is different from the secular. And I actually sort of do some of that work at times. And I like making a distinction between, and this is sort of following Jeff Stout, like between secularism, which is the continued persistence to police religion from the public square, which is different from secularity, which is an account of modernity that acknowledges that multiple epistemologies are viable and that we live in a world in which those multiple epistemologies need room to need room in the public square. And the challenges become then how do you navigate multiple epistemologies, right? So the difference between secularism is a commitment to a singular epistemology, one that polices religion, and secularity is a commitment to a multiplicity of epistemologies that brings its own set of challenges of, okay, well, what is democratic life like when you're a secular of that sort?
Now, you've already mentioned it, but the presence of Charles Taylor is throughout the book.
Yeah.
I noted that he was there a lot. Talal Assad, Saba Mahmood, and political theologians William Kavanaugh and John Milbank are also making appearances here. So there's lots of people, very heavy-duty scholars who are dealing with this issue.
Yeah.
But your book has a special place in this debate. It was, and you've already talked about it a little bit. How is race implicated in the secular to start with?
Yeah. Well, so Charles Taylor, you know, whose work is so important to the field, in the book functions a bit I don't know what the right word is. He functions as sort of a pole of opposition. While lots of us respect Taylor's work, he tells the story of how the secular emerges through, you know, in Western modernity without mentioning a whole set of historical and political conditions that have produced Western modernity. Most significantly, colonialism, the construction of race out of the encounter of the New World and the West, the role that religion plays as a category, both in conquering new land and in constructing race. And so Taylor narrates this story without dealing a whole lot with the way power functions in shaping the geography, shaping the bodies of the people who are participating in Western modernity. And so the book is in some sense set, you know, in opposition to his narrative. I mean, in some sense, he gets something right about the secular being much more complicated than the secularity thesis gives it credit for. But we're trying to say that he's missing a huge part of this story of the secular.
No, you tie religion and race, and I don't know, that I had this overwhelming sort of, like, I was haunted by this idea that and you're mostly talking about African-American here.
Yeah.
Okay. Isn't there sort of a tendency to always think of terms of African-American people as being more religious or more spiritual or having more soul?
Yeah.
Which is
yeah.
all. And how do you avoid that?
Right, right. My man Du Bois is not guilty for that as well. In the association of the spirit with Black folk. I don't think you can avoid it. I think that part of what we're trying to do here, though, is say that the construction of race in modernity relied on religious concepts, just not on the way that racialized understandings, you know, racist understandings of religious concepts tend to function, which is to say that somehow religion is an otherworldly matter, right? So that to be religious is to distance oneself from politics. That's distinctly not what we're saying, right? We're saying
especially since most African American religion is extremely political.
Yes,
it is not a disembodied sort of escape the world, as we've been shown for a long time now.
Right, right. So there's a way in which, like, if you just think of precisely what you said, and compare that to the way the secularity thesis constructs religion, which is as this sort of otherworldly, largely politically, you know, without a voice, sort of notion, privatized, something that the state is, you know, able to police and control. We're saying, without trying to essentialize what African-American religiosity is, we're saying that there are multiple forms of African-American religiosity that contest that account of what religion is in a variety of ways that are really important to point out. And that if we're going to talk about the interpenetrate, if the secular is, as Charles Taylor says, sort of about, you know, is a porous state in which religion, you know, comes in unpredictable ways, then you really need to wrestle with the way racialized subjects have dealt with that. You know, also, one thing I think that you mentioned a bunch of these really important theorists. I mean, I think that one thing we also thought about as we put together this volume was that a lot of the discussion of the secular is incredibly abstract and very difficult to, at times, get one's head around. And what we wanted to do in creating this volume is, I mean, obviously, the people who contribute to this volume are there are plenty of theorists among us, but we also wanted to sort of, you know, gather together a set of essays that have a little more sort of history to them and have sort of social context and engage with, you know, people's lives. And so, you know, we've got essays about Salafism in Philadelphia in the text, or we've got an essay that you know, by Ed Bloom that centers around Henry Box Brown, who mails himself to the North to alleged freedom. We've got, you know, Erica Edwards' essay on Martin Luther King and the Boondocks comic series and an episode of The Twilight Zone. So there's a way in which this volume is absolutely taking on the theory of this literature of the secular, and so theory heads are going to have a good time with the book. But there's also a way in which the book is trying to speak to sort of more concrete moments where some of these theoretical issues are actually grabbing. And that was one of our hopes, you know, in constructing the book.
Well, Lloyd starts with an introduction, which he starts right off with Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah.
And how his persona has been constructed, that has been stripped basically of religion and stripped of his blackness to sort of produce this sort of liberal, white, secular leader in a way, a whitened secular leader. And I think we've seen this phenomenon for a while going on, and scholars do it too.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just in the public arena we ignore the religious aspects of Martin Luther King, even though so many of his speeches were sermons, full of biblical allusions and references to biblical themes.
Right.
So talk about the process of Martin Luther King becoming stripped of all these things.
Yeah, yeah.
And what is the price that we're paying for doing that?
Eric Edwards' essay as well also deals with King and speaks of a similar type of process in which, if you understand the secular as synonymous with the state, the secular is an attempt to sort of control and police subjectivities and political formations that are problematic for it, right? And so what Lloyd argues is that the construction of the monument, and it's such a, I think, brilliant introduction to the construction of the monument, again, sort of in a very literally concrete moment of how this works, right? Construction of King's monument on the Mall represents sort of the state taking over King. And we get this very polished King who is without any of his religious fervor and fire. And frankly, there's no mention at all in the construction of in the language that adorns the King monument. There's no mention at all of his race, of the particular concern he had for black people in his life. And it's an embodied example of the way black bodies are managed by the secular. And what it produces is, you know, a whitewashed King, a King who is not rooted in his actual roots, which are in, you know, reading Cornel West's essay on King as an organic intellectual, is rooted in the black church. And so you get this King that is that is very unchallenging for the state, right? So the king on the monument doesn't give the depth of the degree to which King's vocabulary and King's epistemology were, while trying in some sense to improve the state, were also at odds with the state, and in some sense permanently at odds with the state. I mean, the king was never interested, it seems to me, in being anything other than prophetic and trying to constantly remind the state that its own vocabulary is not sufficient. And yet what we get is a state-sponsored account of King, which essentially, you know, erases that from him.
Which reminds me of something contemporary, the Black Lives Matter movement.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some discussion in the media about how there's a lack of religion in this movement. I'm not sure I buy it.
Yeah.
Okay. It depends on, again, what you define as religion.
Right.
And
right.
Maybe it's not religion of the institutional church,
mm-hmm.
but I'm kind of wondering, do you have any thoughts on that?
And
whether there's some secularism sort of kind of whitewashing the Black Lives Matter project?
Yeah. It's a really interesting and difficult question. So it depends. So as you said, it really depends on what we mean by religion. Religion, when it's understood as institutionalized, right, which King is an institutional religious figure, you know, seems to be, the Black Lives Matter movement is absolutely problematizing religion in those forms and is very suspicious of institutionalized religion. I think that, you know, when the Black Lives Matter movement said this is not your parents' civil rights movement or your grandparents' civil rights movement, I think largely what they're saying is, you know, this is not coming out of the Black Church in the structured institutional forms that it did, which include a lot of, you know, heteronormativity and patriarchy. Right.
And I mean, Frederick Douglass was also not a institutional religious figure, but he had some religiosity in his rhetoric.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you can read, I mean, the narrator Frederick Douglass can easily be read, and I, you know, as a Christian rebirth story, where he's, you know, he's born again through the sacrifice of his aunt, right? So that's what I think is that, so the Black Lives Matter movement, though, is very much open to these, as I called them earlier, sort of heterodox constructions of religiosity, right? So that you, at the same time, while you hear about the opposition to the church, you also hear about sort of you hear a language of spirituality among several of the Black Lives, you know, many of the Black Lives Matter movement. And religious figures are playing roles in the movement, just not as it's not being housed in their institutions as it was before. And so I think that, you know, that this, I mean, what we're trying to say in this book is that the construction of the religious in the Black American tradition is multiple. It's not simply something that resides in the Black church alone. It's obviously not something that resides only in men and heterosexual men. And that you can get a better sense of the sort of complicated way that religion and the secular work by looking at this tradition, and in fact this tradition of heterodox understandings of religion continues to function. I mean, I think that, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, you know there's a lot yet to be written, right? And so much of it is enormously promising, and ultimately, in order to find one's sense of what the movement is supposed to be, you've got to articulate larger value-laden ideals, right? And those ultimately land in the realm of religion. At least religion doesn't become an inappropriate term to start thinking about them.
Right. Now, why is secularism conceived as white? Is that because it came out of Europe? It's a European philosophical movement. Why are we saying it's white?
Yeah, so, and that's also one of the main sort of theses of the book, that one of the reasons why we should think about secularism is because it is often a cover for whiteness, right? And that the secular is a form of whiteness, is sort of one of the more confrontational claims that the book makes. I mean, I think most centrally, the book argues that the secular should be understood as a form of whiteness because the secular is, as its as it's used in our society, it's synonymous with the control that, that the state has on the public, right? And one of the things that that the state does is control the way bodies function in our society. And that this that insofar as the secular is about managing the bodies of its citizens and its non-citizens, right? Figuring out what access they have to resources, determining where they live, you know, determining, you know, their type of schooling that they get. That insofar as the secular is engaged in that work, the secular is complicit with the sort of with the ways that that black bodies, black and brown bodies, are subject to the state.
Well, one of the things that you talk about here, as you just mentioned, the bodies, the control of bodies, mm-hmm. which I think Tracy Fessenden, is that her name?
Fessenden.
Yes, yeah. she's bringing up in the control of women's bodies and sexuality.
Right. Right.
By putting those things in the realm of private, mm-hmm. which where the that's where religion is,
mm-hmm.
it's a way for this the state can sort of control sexuality and women's bodies, not directly but indirectly through the instruments of a managed religion.
That's right. That's right. And that that family and gender and sexual issue that the state allows religion. I mean, you have to ask the question, like, why is it that on issues of abortion, religion is allowed to speak full-throatedly, and we listen in the society to religious arguments about abortion, but we don't listen to religious arguments about poverty, right? You know, why is the state allowed, why is religion allowed to speak clearly there? You know, the state allows it to speak clearly there because the state has sort of relegated those issues. Well, those are going to be privatized issues that are really ultimately about religion. And so I think Tracy's work is about sort of highlighting the assumed norms that govern moral issues that are understood as being under the aegis of religion and not. And, you know, and she wants to say that that just as secularism is a form of whiteness, secularism is also a form of patriarchy and heteronormativity. And if we think about the way women's bodies are managed, we can see it in the workings of state norms for what, you know, where power is allowed to function as far as women's lives go.
Now, you one thing you talk about is not only the management of race, but it's also the management of religion that secularism is engaged in to produce sort of this liberal, very accommodating Protestantism
mm-hmm.
that sort of lets the state do what it wants
mm-hmm.
and kind of minds its own private business.
Mm-hmm.
What is the role? And it was only mentioned maybe once or twice. What is the role of civil religion in this?
Yeah,
is civil religion the same thing as this managed Protestantism you're talking about?
I think so. I mean, I think Robert Bellah's notion of civil religion is part of the construction of the secular. I mean, just insofar as at least as Bellah understands it, you know, civil religion is something that is trying. It's not challenging the norms of the state. It's trying to construct the norms of the state. And I mean, I think that the book is not saying, I mean, the book is not saying like, well, let's just get rid of the secular entirely. And let's just let religious voices speak as loudly as they can. And sort of, you know, try to sort of usher in this age in which, I don't know, where maybe the loudest religious voice is going to win. I mean, I think the book is saying is that, and what we're trying to say is that there have to be moments, or at least we need to be aware of the ways in which the secular, which is a form of civil religion, you know, as much as it is sort of without religion, where the secular has to be challenged, and where can those voices come from? And what we're saying is that religion is one category that at times, not in any essential way, you know, functions to do that. And we'd like to sort of say like, let's keep track. Once you make the move where religion is no longer this thing that you need to sort of, you know, titrate in society in small doses, we might then begin to, you know, think about larger issues that religion at times productively speaks of. So one of the issues that comes up in our book is just, let's talk a little, let's use this moment to talk about the secular and race, to talk about justice. And there are times when religion is going to speak about justice well, and there's times when religion is going to speak about it poorly, and there are times when non-religious, you know, accounts of justice do both good and bad. Okay. And so that's what we're pushing toward.
Now, one of the things that the book talks about is that liberal modernity denies difference. It's a management of difference. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking specifically of Schulman's essay on Black political theology, where mm-hmm. he's drawing from Carl Schmitt, mm-hmm. which is fascinating essay.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that? The secular, it's really what we're talking here is about power.
Right, right.
I mean, you're talking about the secular state as a form of power that tries to manage, and religion is not willing to give up all its power to the state. And so there's a competition going on continuously between the power of the state and the power of religious convictions or values that people are wanting to live by.
Right.
And so when they're competing, you know, who gets the upper hand?
Right. And, you know, George's work is so interesting because his book, American Prophecy, I read as sort of this mea culpa almost by a political theorist saying, you know, for so long, political theorists have had this anti-religious bias in thinking about, and, you know, sort of he situates to some degree Hannah Arendt in this, you know, as someone like this who just sort of sees religion as this thing that really we need to get rid of because it's irrational and has an understanding of the way authority works, that is authority to God, that just goes against what it is to have a democratic state, right? And what Schulman is saying is that what Schulman's book is sort of saying in the essay is like, why is it that African-American people in this country have long used religion to sort of find their way in democracy? It can't be that religion is inherently somehow anti-democratic. And in particular, there may be a way in which that if you don't hold the power reins of democracy, religion may be, and its construction of authority may be particularly helpful in thinking about the way authority works. And what Schulman's essay is saying is that, look, it's a liberal myth to think that in our society, authority is constructed just simply out of consent, right? I mean, the whole idea of political theology and Schmitt's work is like, this is a fable that liberals tell themselves in order to rationalize, you know, a certain ideological claim to power. But really, authority is very arbitrary. And we need to sort of come to terms with that in thinking about democracy.
Yeah, which is who has the say in the exception? When there is an exception, who has the final say? Where does the buck stop?
Right, right.
Does it stop with the state or the sovereign?
Yeah.
Or does it stop with somebody else or somewhere else?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think that you know, George would want to say that in the African-American case, the cases that he looks at, it's the construction of the sovereign is God, but for the purposes of trying to create, I mean, God is used as a ballast against a sort of an abusive state for the purposes of trying to find a certain type of justice and equality within society. That's one version of what he says. He also, though, points to that there's a way in which what's going on now in the sort of, you know, as he says, I think the language he uses, you know, under the sign of Afro-pessimism, is that he sees sort of Afro-pessimism as a political theology that is, in fact, it is talking about authority in this way as arbitrary, as something that is not about democratic consent, but about sort of the seizing of value. But in the case of Afro-pessimism, it's trying to take itself out of the economy of American democracy and saying that that economy is no longer one that seems to be salvageable to us. And so he talks about Richard Eitan's work in his essay, as well as Saida Hartman's work, as a type of Black political theology that is trying to carve out power formations that are no longer engaging with dominant American democracy.
Well, you mentioned Arendt. She was very, what she said about Christianity was that it gave people sort of a pass to opt out of politics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was one of her big problems, that people could just opt out. and not be fully politically engaged because they're hoping for, you know, heaven or the kingdom of God to come or whatever.
Right. Or souls to be saved later.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's interesting with African-American religion for the most part, even though it has a strong sort of hopefulness for the kingdom to come, it's still very much now.
Yeah, I mean, in its traditional forms, absolutely. I mean, there's very little that is about sort of evading this world. It's you know, either about liberation within this world or at least, you know, creative ways of surviving this world. I mean, it's simply synonymous with the everyday as opposed to reaching for something else.
And so to deny religion in terms of how African-American people have expressed it is a way is to deny Black people political subjectivity that one of your authors talks about.
Right, right. I mean, that again is also one of the central themes of the book that, you know, I think I try to write about this a little bit, that the secularity thesis is not a denial. It's not just simply a denial of religion. It's a denial of the sort of political basis of, you know, of the African-American experience in this country. I mean, there is, you know, historically religion has found its way into, you know, essentially most, you know, African-American political moments, at least up until, I mean, now with Black Lives Matter, there may be something different, but you know, also what George's work on political theology is saying, and what Schmidt's saying is like, let's not only think about religion when it's talking about God. I mean, that political theology is how is authority consolidated, and when it's consolidated, that is a theological moment, right? That's what Schmidt's argument is. And so even when Black Lives Matters, if you see Black Lives Matters as an attempt to consolidate Black authority, Black sovereignty, to try to construct Black sovereignty, Schmidt would argue, Shulman argues, that those are theological moments. Those are anti-liberal moments where liberalism, where they reject the idea that what's going on here is, you know, we're coming up with a set of neutral rules by which we're going to engage with each other, right? The theological saying, no, there is a history to why we have authority as we do. And it's one that is, you know, utterly shaped by a certain experience. And those are theological. I mean, so religion is, I mean, it's a bit of a cheap argument to sort of say that religion is there whenever, you know, even when it's not there, which sometimes political theology can turn into. But more particularly, I think the more important point is that religion is, theology is there whenever authority is consolidated, whenever claims to sovereignty are made. And I like that version.
I always say religion is not everything, but it's everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
It shows up everywhere, even though it's not everything.
Right.
Now, I was thinking about what you just said about we have a history, of course, in America of white people trying to secure the separation of church and state. Mm-hmm. And for Black people, that really wasn't the big issue.
Mm-hmm.
The big issue was how to actualize the freedom that they believe their religion gave them,
yeah,
their Christian freedom, in a political arena that denied it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, historically, white religiosity, white Christianity in this country, of course, has been used to promulgate racism as much as anything else, right? So if you look back to slavery or Jim Crow, you know, the white church is vocal in so many ways about the appropriateness of racialized laws and situations for Christianity. Christianity mandates this, right? And what's so interesting is that the African-American tradition largely has not responded by saying we need to keep church and state separate.
Right.
Right. The response has been, and actually Vincent writes about this in his most recent book, response has been that there's a natural law claim to God that supersedes, you know, this understanding of religion. And, you know, that is, I think, a consistent impulse here in Black political formation. Again, Shulman's work speaks to this, which is, you know, how is it that left-leaning political theorists have overlooked the ways in which African Americans use God to construct political formations? What's important here is that we're not trying to essentialize religion in the Black church. Toni Morrison's understanding of God and spirituality in Beloved, which is very heterodox and as much anti-Christian as it is it challenges a normative understanding of Christianity. However, it is not an embrace of a certain type of secularity or secularism that says religion should be kept out of it, right? And it's that idea that if we're going to have political formation, it can't simply work by setting up supposedly neutral rules, which are going to work their magic and deal with every citizen as though that citizen doesn't have a past, as though every citizen is going to be dealt with from behind the veil of ignorance. African American experience of liberalism, many whites' experience of liberalism is not that liberalism functions in this neutral way, right? And so that you need ways of consolidating one's own understanding of authority in order to live within the system.
Okay, we've been talking a lot of theoretical stuff, which is very interesting to me, but I wanted to get to some of the second set of essays, which are a little bit more concrete. One is Edward Blum's essay on Henry Box Brown as an example of resistance to this management of race and religion.
Yeah.
And how he manages, Box Brown manages not only to escape racial slavery, but to reimagine religion from white masters who are gods to white masters being the devil.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he escapes in two ways, his body, and he escapes his mental imaginary about who God is. Can you talk a little bit about that? And how does Blum challenge Charles Taylor's account?
For me, that's one of the most important moments of the book, because one of the things that Taylor says is that, you know, in this new secular age, we have a buffered self, and ourselves are no longer porous, Charles Taylor says, which means that, you know, before the secular age, I don't know, 1,000 years ago, ourselves, this is on Taylor's construction, ourselves were subject to religious forces, and they just incurred into our lives. Religion was something that just interpenetrated who we were, and that secularity, as it's constructed now, is we're buffered from that, and we have choices about whether or not we want to subject ourselves or we want to be subjected to religious notions, right? And so that the secular self today is a self that is marked by a heightened ability to choose what one experiences, right?
Which I wonder whether there's a myth there, the myth of choice. And sociologically, is that true that we're so embedded into our environment, the idea that we have choice always, and it is, I have a problem with that. I don't know how far our choice goes.
No, absolutely. I mean, so part of the good work that Taylor does is sort of contest the Enlightenment construction of the secularization thesis. The part of the criticism of him is that he produces an Enlightenment account of what it is to have a self, which is a buffered self, right? So what Blum does is say, like, this idea of a buffered self as somehow able to choose what social forces it needs to manage, is belied by Henry Box Brown, who literally, you know, put himself into a box and produced and punctured it with holes so he could breathe to get himself out of slavery. And it just embodies and personifies, you know, the ways, and I think Blum really nicely plays with the word holy. That box is holy. It's holy in the sense it literally has holes, but that it becomes the site of religious holiness as well, you know, confounding white Christianity and producing a distinctly African-American version of Christianity. And so it's an example of a literally porous self. Right, it's a porous box. Brown doesn't have the choice to sort of choose a subjectivity that either accepts religion or not. He is dealing with social forces that engage his body in such a way that, in his moment, produce religiosity and produce a religious self. And I think what's important about Blum's essay, as well as our book, is that none of us are saying that somehow that, you know, African-American life is essentially religious. This is to get back to your point. But under particular historical conditions, African-American life was by necessity worked through by religion. And it very well may be that in modernity, as life, you know, moves forward in the future, that religion will be not the trope and not the means by which African-Americans manage and try to exist with still poor selves, right? But the idea is that it's a mistake of whiteness to think that the self is somehow emerged from secularism as buffered, as able to keep forces, social forces away from oneself.
Yeah, it doesn't even seem sociologically or psychologically viable. It may be philosophically an argument, but it doesn't seem to be really on the ground.
Yeah.
Something that is true. And the Bloom's essay, I really liked when he's talking about that he thought the masters were God.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he realized they weren't God and they became devils.
Right.
And I just thought that was just really fascinating because that changed everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, politically, it changed everything.
Right. Right. Sort of this,
reimagining.
Yeah, my roots in Nietzsche, like the revaluation of value. Is so important to Box Brown.
The other one that I was really happy to see was this Joel Bletcher and Joshua Dubler's Salafism, Muslims of Philadelphia. I thought that was very interesting in how they talked about how these particular Muslims, black Muslims, are challenging the secular.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they're an example of that Arendt would say, see, religion is a way for them to escape the political.
Yeah. It's right. And, you know, they would be, I mean, that is a fascinating essay because they're interested in this particular African-American religious formation, not as something that is trying to somehow contest the state's authority, but trying to take African-American life away from the state. Right. So that, you know, that, I mean, it's an important essay because so many of the examples in the essay, in the book we have, are of African-American moments in which religion and politics come together to challenge the state and to assert a sort of a type of contest against the state, to take the state on. And what the Salafis, as they describe it, are doing in Philadelphia is saying, you know, we need to have agency over our categories of religion, because this is how we're going to self-determine. And so what they're saying is that even in the cases where African Americans are using religion to distance themselves from the state, it's still a political move. This is not somehow like pie in the sky and let's wait for later. This is about forming a particular type of black centered community within Philadelphia. And it still has, I mean, I think that the subtext of their essay is this is still a political thing. It's just not a political thing in terms of joining the state. It probably continues to contest the state, right? Because what they're doing is saying we are not going to be controlled by the state's norms as much as the state wants to do that to us.
Right. And like, we're not going to like advocate against racism or some of these things that are very much in our public dialogue. It reminds me of Christian anarchism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The idea that God is sovereign.
Right.
And that the state should not be given any priority whatsoever.
Right, right. And that somehow religious victory is synonymous with political power, right?
Right.
So many formations of Christianity, you know, do that, that they somehow think that religiosity finds its best pronunciation when it's gotten a hold of a certain type of state power. And there's a way in which, you know, the Salafis are saying, like, we're not going to give the state that type of sovereignty, right? This is not our ultimate goal here. And so I suppose they're quiescent, that's the critique of them. But ultimately, they're not, because they're about the formation of their community.
Yeah, no, I think that they're probably a good example of maybe hundreds or thousands of communities different religious persuasions that are doing exactly the same thing.
Right.
I mean, I read this as sort of an example of how religion responds to the secular state.
Yeah.
And not as the only one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Precisely that it's not, you know, it's not a, they're not, while not being publicly political in their expressions of the religion, they're not accepting the privatized account of what religion is. Religion for the Salafis is everything. It's every part of their lives. They can't disentangle it from the way that they engage with every single aspect of who they are. And so in that, they're rejecting a very sort of secular understanding of religion as this sort of feeling in one's heart that one carries around solely in an ethereal way.
Okay, I'm just thinking about William Kavanaugh and his Catholic anarchism. I don't know.
Right.
It just seems to be some...
Very simple, I think, yeah.
Very simple, what he's saying. Okay,
yeah.
The other thing about the book that was really interesting is that you managed to bring in him. You got a lot of stuff in there. You got gender in there, which at the very end, but you got it in there.
Yes.
And then there was a transnational aspect of this.
Yeah.
That you went beyond America and you started looking a little broader at, and there's that one essay about West Africa, Haiti, and the U.S. South about these ideas, the tropes of the fetish, the frenzy, and the voodoo as tropes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, both
that mark both religious and racial difference and how they've been used politically.
Yeah. I mean, I think that you know, critiques of the book can be that it understands race too narrowly. So it understands understands race mostly in the form of, you know, African-American constructions of race. And another critique of the book can be that it's too America-centered, right? So that while we do it's sort of against the way American studies also, you know, functions today, which is to be as transnational as it can be, as it, you know, the more transnational, the better. And I think those are legitimate critiques. I mean, we were aware of that. That our account of race was limited to Black American constructions. We wanted this to be a beginning point for this conversation. So let's invite Asian and Latino accounts of race here too.
Because yeah, I was thinking about Latino, and I was thinking about the both the Catholic Latino and also the Protestant or Pentecostal. Latino who would have they would have their own take on particularly the Pentecostals on the state.
That's right. That's right. And that work sort of, you know, needs to be done. And then, you know, both Bill Hart and Willie Jennings, essays are essays that sort of, you know, root the constructions of race in the colonial encounter. And that's sort of in some sense why we began. I mean, that, you know, why we began and in the slave trade. And that ultimately, you know, sort of is crucial to us, that this whole discussion is not just about sort of what happens within the American borders, but has deeper roots in enormous forces of modernization that are transnational. I mean, Cooper Harris's essay, in which he speaks about the ways that constructions of race influence droning practices, and, you know, the way drones are used by the government, it is also an attempt, I think, to sort of make this story more transnational. That there's a way in which, you know, as Saba Mahmoud talks about, that the secular is now exported in this war on Islam. And constructions of race make drones, you know, the overlap of race and religion, you know, brown Muslims make, allows for drones in ways that really we haven't examined.
Which brought to mind the book by Saba Mahmoud, Religious Difference in a Secular Age.
Yeah.
In her book, she talks about how secularism, the exportation of secularism to these Muslim countries, she's specifically talking about Egypt, actually,
yep,
through colonialism, created a religious strife and issues.
Right.
It by privatizing religion and doing certain, giving religion certain privileges. And her book is very interesting because it dovetails with what you're doing here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the story she's telling is very complex, and, you know,
yes,
again,
it is.
Yeah. And again, the way that secular nationalism, you know, allows certain areas where religion can have agency and power. Those are oftentimes within the family and having to do with gender.
Marital family law and marital law and that sort of thing. Yes.
Yeah.
Which women have not done so well with that.
That's right. And that, you know, those are not, though they are understood, you know, as private because they have to do with, you know, the family, which in the secular West gets, you know, is conducted behind closed doors. They're ultimately not private issues at all, right? They're deeply issues of public norms. And that the sort of attempt, I mean, her argument is the attempt to do this by the West to sort of control religion by giving it this domain of private life has entirely come home to roost.
Oh, yeah. She's talking about all the consequences of that. But
yeah.
Let me ask you about your book again. Where do you think this book will be useful? And mm-hmm. are you hearing back from people? What are you hearing?
Well, we hope that it's useful in the classroom most primarily, right? I mean that we're hopeful that it's going to be taught. We're hearing that certain essays of it are already being taught. I mean, I've taught it. I taught a class this last spring. I think that it provides. I mean, because it's such a different volume in light of the rest of the work on the secular, because none of the rest of the work on the secular is talking about the obviously deeply important issues of race and power in the way this book does. I think that it's sort of essential for any class that is trying to sort of think about what is this really robust discussion of the secular in the last 20 years? Because this is really the only book that centrally is focused on the ways that, and that really makes the claim that the secular needs to be understood as a form of whiteness.
It's interesting what you're talking about, because I'm thinking about Catherine Lofton's book on Oprah,
mm-hmm.
in which she puts together Oprah as a religious figure.
Mm-hmm.
She's an African-American religious figure.
Mm-hmm.
It's interpreted as being a secular person.
Right.
With a mostly white audience.
Right, right.
And
also not very political, she's understood as.
Right, exactly. So, I'm thinking that Lofton's book sort of begins to bring this kind of stuff together. She's doing something different because she's doing a cultural analysis. But
Right. Anyway,
it just reminds me of some of the things and themes in the book that you've just put together.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that when you look at the intersection of race and religion, what we're saying is that you're also looking at the intersection of how the state of political modes of being in the state, right? And so that when, you know, in the case of Oprah, there's this the role that her type of religiosity plays is one that is about a certain type of managing of race and how race, you know, functions and produces an ideal that, at least on the surface, is attempting to, you know, to create something of a raceless society. That's important to see that the attempt to do that is the work of the secular. The attempt to make it more complex, you have to engage challenges to that, which often include religion. And that's sort of the central thrust of this book, which is that, you know, accounts of the secular, can be and need to be disrupted as much as possible, at least insofar as the secular is about, you know, the management of religion for the purposes of projects of the state.
Okay. We're out of time, Jonathan. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
You've been very generous. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in American Studies. It would be a pleasure to hear from you. You can reach me through my website, www.lillianbarger.com. This is your host, Lillian Barger.